Welcome to the Women's Wellness Psychiatry Podcast. I'm so glad you're here. I'm your host, Anna Glazer, MD, a reproductive and integrative psychiatrist here to help you make sense of the complex world of women's mental health. If your goal is to improve your emotional well-being, find fulfillment, and feel like your best self, you're in the right place. Welcome, my listener friends. I'm excited to share this episode with you, where I chat with Dr. Eid on the topic of nutritional psychiatry. What we eat impacts so much of our medical, physiological, psychological, environmental, and social experiences. And there is so much information out there about food and nutrition, and so many mixed messages. In this episode, we're going to begin by defining important terms like nutritional and metabolic psychiatry. We're going to discuss the challenges with the research that are out there on this topic, and really chat about how your food impacts your mental health. Now, nutritional psychiatry is actually a topic that's discussed more in depth for clinicians who join my online course, the Fellowship in Reproductive and Integrative Psychiatry. So take a look at the link in the show notes to learn more about that. And now let me introduce Dr. Georgia Eady, who is an internationally recognized expert in nutritional and metabolic psychiatry. Her 25 years of clinical experience include 12 years at Smith College and Harvard University Health Services, where she was the first to offer students nutrition-based approaches as an alternative to psychiatric medication. She co-authored the first inpatient study of the ketogenic diet for treatment-resistant mental illness, developed the first medically accredited course in ketogenic diets for mental health practitioners, and was honored to be named the recipient of the Baszucki Brain Research Fund's first annual Metabolic Mind Award. Her new book, Change Your Diet, Change Your Mind, was recently released in January 30th of this year. And there's a link to learn more about that book and to learn more about Dr. Georgia Eady in the show notes. So please take a listen to my wonderful conversation with Dr. Georgia Eady. Thank you so much, Dr. Eady, for joining me on this episode of this podcast. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for inviting me, Dr. Glazer.
Why don't we start by your sharing with listeners a little bit more about your professional background so they can get to know you.
Sure. I went to medical school at the University of Vermont back in the 90s to get my medical degree. And then I did my residency, my psychiatry residency at Cambridge Hospital, which is one of the, it's a training program within the Harvard system in Massachusetts. But there are several different training, psychiatry residency training programs in that system. And the Cambridge Hospital training program had a particular pride in teaching not just psychopharmacology and prescribing medications, but also in teaching psychotherapy. And it really valued the psychotherapy and the therapeutic relationship between psychiatrists and people who come to them for help. And so I got more training in that than I think most psychiatrists do. And then after I finished my trace of 4 years, obviously psychiatry residency training program, then I moved to Cape Cod and opened a practice. It was kind of a hybrid practice where part of the practice was hospital-based consult liaison, seeing patients in the hospital who were there for medical reasons, but happened to also have psychiatric conditions that needed attention and evaluation, and also a community-based practice, a clinic, a mental health clinic that took all kinds of insurances. And I had a couple of really great colleagues there. The three of us worked in that community-based clinic on Cape Cod. It was called Cape Cod Human Services. And then also a small private practice component as well. So it was three prongs to my initial practice. And I worked there for 5 years in those different capacities and then returned to the Harvard system, but this time to work at Harvard University Health Services, working with students, faculty, and staff, psychotherapy, medication management, but then was gradually allowed to incorporate some nutrition principles into my work there. That was back in 2007. And my practice has really, over the years, now become 100% nutrition and metabolism based. I was at Harvard University Health Services for 6 or 7 years. And then I was at Smith College for 5 years, very similar position. And since 2018, I've been working independently from the college mental health system, even though I loved it. It really was my specialty. I had done extra fellowship time learning about college mental health and really loved it. But I will also say that what I was able to do with nutrition and mental health in the college setting was very limited. So that was one of the many reasons why I left my beloved specialty of college mental health to work independently in nutrition and metabolic psychiatry.
So how did you become passionate about nutrition? Because we received, I think maybe there was two lectures, if I remember correctly, on nutrition in med school, when I went to med school. And then I think in residency, I don't think that maybe we had a lecture on nutritional metabolic psychiatry. If we did, I don't quite remember what it was about. And certainly nutritional psychiatry is something that there's been a lot more in terms of training and in the news more recently, and something that I've been able to incorporate more of in my work. But it's something that you have to seek out and become educated on. And so I'm curious, how did you become passionate about nutrition?
What you said is exactly my experience. I think we had 2 or maybe 3 hours of nutrition lectures in medical school, 4 years of medical school. And in residency, I don't recall talking about food once.
And it wasn't even, now that I remember correctly, the nutrition in med school was always on those really esoteric conditions, those malnutrition conditions that most of us, in terms of the patients that we see today, we've never actually even seen.
That's right. And the only other things I remember talking about nutrition-wise in residency were, what's a low tyramine diet for someone who's taking an MAO inhibitor? And of course, very few people, even back then, were taking those medications. Yeah, we really didn't talk about food. We didn't even talk about food when we were talking about how to help people with eating disorders. That it just wasn't part of, it just wasn't on our minds. I mean, it didn't cross my mind that nutrition could be used as a tool to help people with mental health conditions. It didn't cross my mind once. And not even in the first 10 years of my practice when I was on the Cape. And then it never crossed my mind. And the way I became interested was for my own selfish purposes. I was developing some mysterious health syndromes, for lack of a better description, in my early 40s that I think are quite common in middle-aged women. And a lot of the women who came to see me were also struggling with these things. Things like chronic fatigue and fibromyalgia and migraines and IBS and all these sort of just start not feeling well in general, despite doing everything I knew how to do. I thought I knew what was the right thing to do. I was exercising religiously 6 to 7 days a week, and I was running and I was going to the gym and I was, you know, eating my low fat, low cholesterol, high fiber diet and having my diet cokes and my big salads and my sugar-free soy milk and my bran cereals and fat-free yogurts. I was doing what I thought I was supposed to do, and I just was not feeling well. And so I went to lots of different specialists to try to figure out what was wrong. And all my tests came back normal. By then, I was then working in the Harvard system, and I had access to all kinds of very, really top-notch specialists, and everything came back normal. And they sent me home with the same generic sheet about what I was supposed to do to take care of myself, which was exercise every day and eat a low-fat, high-fiber diet. I was already doing that. So I was left to my own devices to try to figure it out. And long story short, I ended up figuring out that if I turned my diet almost entirely upside down from what I had been taught was healthy, I could reverse every symptom that I was having. And that led me to study nutrition independently for years, quite obsessively. And that led me ultimately to begin incorporating nutrition principles into my work with people who were interested in something other than medication.
And you use two separate terms, and I'm hoping you can define for our listeners maybe the difference or the similarity. You use the term nutritional psychiatry and metabolic psychiatry. Can you share with listeners what those two terms mean?
Yes. So nutritional psychiatry, that term is now used to describe a particular branch of psychiatry, a sort of a subspecialty within psychiatry. The modern version of nutritional psychiatry has really been around maybe a little more than 10 years now. And that field was defined and described primarily by Professor Felice Jacko, who is a research psychologist at the University of Deakin in Australia. She and her colleagues have written a number of papers and conducted a number of studies in this area. And it's a very large, it's a growing subspecialty, but she is one of the leaders in that field. And she has used this term nutritional psychiatry to really to describe, and I identify with this, really to describe a field of study where we are interested in understanding the dietary root causes of mental health conditions. And the belief in the subspecialty of nutritional psychiatry is that the steep rise in mental health conditions of many kinds parallels and is largely driven by the deterioration in the quality of our diet over the past 50 to 75 years. So it's really about dietary quality. And I very much ascribe to that philosophy that I do think that the way that we have been eating is playing a big part in why we're not feeling as well or functioning as well as we should. That field largely focuses on the Mediterranean diet, not entirely. But most thought leaders in that field would recommend the Mediterranean diet as a better alternative to the standard American diet, which we all know is not good for us. The term metabolic psychiatry, it's a newer term. It came about just a little more than 5 years ago, and that term was coined by Dr. Shabani Sethi at Stanford University. I also identify as a metabolic psychiatrist. And metabolic psychiatrists are interested in the metabolic root causes of mental health conditions, the relationship between, say, for example, blood sugar and insulin levels and how the brain fuels itself and generates energy, what that relationship is. And so to what extent do conditions like prediabetes or type 2 diabetes or insulin resistance, to what extent do those metabolic problems influence and contribute to poor mental health? And really, I think, and the reason why I wrote the book is to really marry these two fields together, because both of these things are so important. Yes, of course, nutritional quality is important and metabolic quality is important. We want to nourish and protect the brain with the food choices that we make, but we also want to protect its energy supply by keeping a very close eye on our glucose and insulin levels. So that's why I consider myself both a nutritional psychiatrist and a metabolic psychiatrist.
They sound like they really should be married.
Yes, I think we have a very healthy relationship.
Yes. And you mentioned that you self-taught yourself a lot of this information. And I think one of the challenges is that there's a lot of conflicting evidence and prescriptions for various diets out there. And so could you talk a little bit about why is that? Why is consensus in nutritional science so hard?
I love that you asked this question because it really shouldn't be. It doesn't need to be. The biology of nutrition is really straightforward and really quite, so it's not rocket science. But the problem is that the way the relationship between food and human health and disease has been studied has not been scientific. The methods that have been used have been based in guesswork and wishful thinking and theories and hopes and dreams about what we wish a healthy diet looked like that aren't grounded in a biological understanding of the brain, the body, human physiology, or even the nutritional quality of the foods that we eat. It's been largely untested theories based on wishful thinking and wild guesses. And therefore, it allows, because there hasn't been any scientific experimentation involved in that main methodology that's used to generate most nutrition headlines, and much of our dietary guidelines are based on that kind of a study, which is not scientific. It's based on this questionnaire-based guesswork. So because there's no scientific experimentation to test those theories to see if they're actually true, what happens is that people, including the researchers themselves, can continue to believe in incorrect theories for their entire careers because they're never tested to see whether or not they're true. So this opens the door for people's ideas and beliefs and hopes about nutrition to thrive and flourish without any evidence behind them. And people have very strong feelings about nutrition on all sides.
Yes,
so
they do.
Until you actually look at the science and actually do experiments to figure out what's going on, then you can believe in a particular dietary philosophy, even if it's incorrect.
And it's so hard. I think a lot of the science focuses on people writing their diary cards of what they ate and if you ask me today what I ate yesterday, I probably can't tell you. I really need to spend some time thinking about it, maybe check my kitchen. And so it's really hard to use that kind of data to formulate conclusions.
Exactly. So you're giving a perfect example. So when these studies are called nutrition epidemiology studies, and they're most nutrition studies come from that methodology. And the methodology is they're called food frequency questionnaires. So, and I give examples of this in the book where you might say, for example, let's say you question 10,000 people about their eating habits, and you'll give them all the same questionnaire, and you'll ask them questions like, how many half cup servings of blueberries have you eaten on average over the past year?
How much is even a half cup of blueberries?
And so there are questions like this on these questionnaires. And so people are asked these questions that are impossible to answer with any sense of clarity, any accuracy. So they're really guessing about how many blueberries they've passed year. And you're not allowed to say, I don't know, or I don't remember, or you must be kidding. You have to fill in a frequency and a quantity once a week, twice a week, three times. And so that's the so-called data that is used to generate the headlines and the findings in these studies. And there is no real data in these studies. There's nothing concrete or measured. Nothing's being recorded or measured. And lots and lots and lots of foods aren't asked about at all. So it's just a few foods that the researchers are interested in that get all the attention. And then there are hundreds of items that aren't on the questionnaire at all. So it's really completely unscientific. We really, like you said, we have no idea. I couldn't tell you what I ate last week, let alone a year ago. And so that a lot of people will say nutrition epidemiological data is the best we can do. It's not data at all. And I don't remember if I used this line in the book, is a car without wheels better than no car at all? It doesn't work. It's not valid. And so I don't think we should be using it to influence our nutrition, the food choices that we make for ourselves, our families, and the way that we guide our patients in our clinical work should not be based on these wild guesses.
And so what about the current way of eating and the standard American diet, which I always think it's so great that the acronym for the standard American diet is the SAD diet, because it really does make us all quite sad. So what is the relationship between the SAD diet and mental health?
Yeah, so there's a lot of really good evidence that so over the past 10, 15 years, we've learned so much more. And I know you've talked about it on your own podcast. We've learned so much more about the root causes or the root drivers of mental health conditions. And it goes so much beyond the sort of so-called chemical imbalances that I was taught about back in the 90s and early 2000s, dopamine and serotonin and glutamate and GABA. And even to the extent that these conditions are influenced by neurotransmitter regulation problems, what's causing those, right? So now we understand so much more about inflammation of the brain playing a big role in conditions like depression and something called oxidative stress, which if you look at just about any mental or physical health condition, you will see signs of inflammation and oxidative stress. And oxidative stress is why we're told we're supposed to eat foods rich in antioxidants, but we're not asked to think about what are we eating that's causing all this excessive oxidative stress in the first place. And then the third piece, so we've got inflammation, oxidative stress, and the third piece that's playing a major role in physical and mental health problems of all kinds is insulin resistance, or what's sometimes called prediabetes or metabolic syndrome. And this is just high insulin levels running too high because we're eating too many of the wrong things too often. So insulin, so these three pillars, so inflammation, oxidative stress, insulin resistance, those are the things that seem to be the major players, the major culprits in reversible root causes of mental health conditions. And what we really need to do is if you're trying to find out, okay, why do we have all this extra inflammation and oxidative stress and what causes insulin resistance, you need look no further than the standard American diet for the drivers of those drivers. And specifically, the so-called SAD diet, which I agree is a great acronym for what's going on here, the signature ingredients of that diet, what makes it so different, what really stands out about our modern industrialized diet that makes it different from all the healthier diets that ever came before it, are a huge amount of refined carbohydrates, sugars, flours, and cereals, and that sort of thing, and refined seed oils. So things like soybean oil and safflower oil and sunflower oil and canola oil. These ingredients were, especially the vegetable oils, so-called vegetable oils, they were really not part of the human diet before about 100 years ago. They're very new. And refined carbohydrates, we've had those for a long time in our diet, but not to the extent that we do now. It's just most of what we're eating now. Almost every so-called ultra-processed food or factory food contains refined carbohydrates, vegetable oils, or both.
And I think we could certainly, it's probably beyond the scope of our conversation today to dive into some of the societal challenges with the farm subsidies and the agriculture issues and all of the probably inappropriate financial directions that promote the seed oils and all of those kinds of things, probably beyond our scope. So we'll focus more on the individual. And so one of the things that also that struck me, because we're talking about mental health and this is a women's mental health podcast, is when you were introducing yourself, you had mentioned that you were in your early 40s when you began to notice some of these shifts and challenges. And that's something that I see in so many of my patients. There's a lot more conversation these days on perimenopausal transitions, which could be a decade or more. And some of the nutritional shifts that might need to take place at that time and just women's mental health symptoms. So I'm just wondering if you have thoughts on some of the specific nutritional challenges that women might be facing or that could impact their mental health and maybe particularly as it relates to hormonal health.
Absolutely. So many things we could talk about there. And I'm so glad you brought it up. This doesn't come up enough. When we're talking about nutrition and mental health, is the special challenges that women face both hormonally and from a food culture perspective, what women believe they are supposed to eat and what they are expected to eat, what we think of as food for women is, and as so very different from how we think about food for men. And so there are lots of things to talk about there, but then also hormonal challenges, right? So when we're going through our 40s, we get this gradual decrease in estrogen as we approach our 50s. And this has a tremendous impact on our gut health, on our insulin, on insulin resistance. Women, as they're losing estrogen and also a certain amount of growth hormone and testosterone as well, as we're going through these hormonal changes, it's influencing in a negative fashion our gut health, our musculoskeletal health, our brain health, and also our metabolic health. So many women will notice if they spend, let's say that in their 20s and 30s and 40s, they had always, if they tended to gain weight at all, they might have gained it around their hips and thighs. Suddenly they're starting to gain it more around their middle than around their hips and thighs, which is more of a male pattern. Men in their 30s and 40s, you'll see that they gain weight around the middle. Sometimes they call it a beer belly, but you see it even in men who don't drink beer. The reason is men are more insulin resistant. It's estrogen that protects us, that separates us from men until it no longer does. Mm-hmm. And so once we enter the perimenopausal years, we start to lose some of that metabolic advantage. And women will start to gain weight around the middle, become more insulin resistant. They'll start to gain weight more easily. Maybe they've maintained their weight very easily without having to think about it for 45 years. And now suddenly, every year, they're gaining a few pounds and they don't know why. Nothing's changed. They're still exercising the same amount. They're still eating the same foods. Something has changed on the inside, and that's all about hormones. Yes, this is another piece of the puzzle. So the hormonal piece, which most women are not taught about, most clinicians are not taught to think about with their female patients. And then there's the food, the expectations around food and how to maintain a healthy weight and how to stay metabolically healthy is upside down. The information is upside down. We're supposed to eat low fat. We're supposed to be very careful with animal foods. When you think of a healthy diet for a woman who's trying to control her weight, you wouldn't picture her sitting down to eat a fatty piece of meat, right? That would be not only considered unladylike, but would be considered a heart attack on a plate and very unhealthy. When really it's the cereals and the fruit juices and the granola bars and the sweetened yogurts and all of these things that are causing so much of the problem in the first place. So it's the wrong information about food, but it's also not having enough information or the correct information about how to safely, both emotionally and physically, navigate the biggest change that women will ever go through, which is in our 40s and 50s. And I'm still learning about this myself. I think that a good deal of what happened for me in my early 40s had to do with these hormonal shifts. And I'm still learning as much as I can about the relationship between the hormonal changes that women go through, their metabolic health, their mental health, their gut health, their musculoskeletal health. And so it's a big topic, and you may know more about it than I do, given the kind of work that you do in integrative psychiatry. So you may, I would love to hear anything you want to chip into the conversation as well.
One of the, I would say, and of course, we know that these kinds of recommendations are very individualized, but I would say that one of the most common recommendations that I make is actually to increase protein, because I do feel like a lot of women are definitely under consuming the amount of protein that their body needs, especially as some of their hormones might be falling off, and they need to actually eat more protein to prevent muscle and bone loss. And so I'm curious if you might have, not necessarily even for that perimenopausal window of time, but if you have some of the most common recommendations that you tend to make with some of your patients.
Yes. And under eating protein, or even just under eating in general, where women are, to eat lightly, eat carefully, eat lots of plants and eat low fat. And all of these things, those kinds of things were burned into my food brain as well for several decades. And we weren't taught how much protein do we need to be healthy. We weren't taught about which foods are the most nutritious. And for example, a really good iron deficiency. So on average, 20% of women around the world of reproductive age are iron deficient. And this is unacceptable. It's not normal. A lot of people think, I've read this in scientific papers and just absolutely flabbergasts me every time I see it. Though, of course, women are iron deficient, it's because they have menstrual cycles and they are losing iron every month. What species would be intentionally designed to become deficient in a key nutrient? That just doesn't make any sense. It's partly because we're not taught where the iron is. A lot of people know that iron is in red meat. But so if you're not going to eat red meat, which we're advised not to do, where are you going to get your iron and how much do you need? And the other thing is that do women know that the foods that they are advised to base their diet on, which are the grains and the legumes and the nuts and the seeds, the plant-based proteins, you can meet your protein requirements through using plant foods alone if you plan your diet carefully. But those foods are rich in anti-nutrients, including compounds that interfere strongly with our ability to absorb iron, not just from those foods themselves, but from the foods we eat along with those foods. So these are anti-iron foods. So it's really, I think, largely the result of incorrect nutrition information that we have such a widespread iron deficiency problem.
And you also spoke about kind of food quality. And that's something that I definitely talk with a number of my patients about, is a lot of our foods, even the soil that they're grown in, has been depleted of nutrients. And if the soil that your food is being grown in is depleted of, let's say, magnesium or some of these other nutrients, nitrates, etc., then the foods themselves aren't necessarily going to contain what you might need. And so that's, I think, part of the reason that sometimes we use supplements for people, because they're not necessarily able to, even when they try to get it from some of the foods, they're not always able to do. I'm wondering if you have thoughts about the changes in food quality and how it's grown in this country.
Oh my gosh, yes. And so two pieces to that. So one is that almost all the food that's produced by our industry, mass produced, both plant and animal foods, are the quality of these foods is deteriorating, not just in terms of its nutritional quality, but also in terms of its toxicity because of the pesticides and so forth, and antibiotics and all kinds of things that we use to mass produce food that's going to look good in a grocery store. And so you can't have spots on your apples and you can't have that sort of thing. If you're going to raise animals in really tight quarters, you're going to, some of them are going to get sick and then you're going to need antibiotics. It's just the whole system is so broken that, so there's that piece. But the other piece is that it's the ultra processed foods or the refined carbohydrates and the vegetable oils. These foods, it's not just enough to eat the right foods. You have to avoid the wrong foods. So these refined carbohydrates and vegetables, what's happening is that they change the way nutrients are processed in the body, and they increase the demand for nutrients. So and magnesium is a perfect example of this. If you're going to eat a diet if you're going to try to run most of your cells on sugar, you're going to need a lot more magnesium to run those reactions than you do if you're going to spend at least some of each day burning fat, because burning fat uses different pathways and uses less magnesium. So this is just one example. And B vitamins are in a similar boat, meaning that when we're eating the right way, we don't need as many of these nutrients. But then the other piece, and I think this is really important, what you said, even if you're eating the ideal diet, whatever that is, pretend to know what that is. But if you're eating the ideal diet, then you may not be able to absorb properly all the nutrients from your food, because you might have gut damage or you might have metabolic damage that is interfering with your ability to obtain all the nutrients you need, even from a very nutritious diet. And as we age, that can become impaired as well. So where are the nutrients in your foods? Are you eating the foods that are highest in nutrients? Are you avoiding foods that are high in anti-nutrients? Are you avoiding the ultra processed foods that are driving up your nutrient requirements? Are you taking good care of your gut health and your metabolic health so that you can make the most of those, of the nutrients that you're taking in? All of these things are connected. So yes, there absolutely is a role in some folks, even if they're eating a really good diet, supplements still have a place. And it's really important. I do this in my practice. I'm sure you do as well. I test for certain common nutrient deficiencies because I use a lot of ketogenic diets in my practice, but all the ketones in the world aren't going to help you if your depression or psychosis is due to a serious B12 deficiency. That needs to be paid attention to as well. And that's why, again, I like to marry these two fields of metabolic psychiatry, nutritional psychiatry, so that we're not missing the most important drivers of poor mental health and giving people the best possible chance at recovery.
And I think to the point that you made earlier when we were talking about the neurotransmitter and amine theories of psychiatry, all of those neurotransmitters for their formation need vitamin and nutrient cofactors, and they're all part of that pathway. So if you're missing that, you won't be able to make any of your own proper neurotransmitters. So that, I think, is another piece to all of that as well.
Exactly. And so many of the neurotransmitters are made from amino acids, which come from dietary protein. And as you were saying before, some people are under eating protein. And so that can be an important barrier to robust mental health.
Yeah. So what are some other kind of most common, perhaps, myths about nutrition and mental health?
Yeah. One of the most common ones is that there are brain superfoods. And so this is a really popular, pretty much every day an article comes out, a headline comes out that it's chia seeds, it's blueberries, it's, I don't know, red wine, it's dark chocolate, it's kale, whatever it is. It's acai, there are lots of different turmeric, lots of different, they're usually colorful plant foods, which are being recommended. Sometimes it's nuts. Occasionally you see an article about salmon. The fact is that improving brain health using food is not about sprinkling superfoods on top of your diet. And it's also not about nibbling around the edges of your diet by just taking some of the bad things out, which in my opinion, that's what the Mediterranean diet does. The Mediterranean diet is healthier, absolutely, than the sad standard American diet. It is, but in my opinion, it doesn't go nearly far enough because it still allows and even encourages certain types of refined carbohydrates, alcohol, and lots of anti-nutritious, very high carbohydrate staple foods, which are for the majority of us who now have insulin resistance, it's just, we're not going to be able to safely process a diet that contains 45 to 65% carbohydrate. So if you want real change to your mental health, you need to make real change to your diet. And those changes need to make biological sense. So you need to fundamentally restructure your diet from the ground up. You can't just nibble at it around the edges and take some of the sugar out. You can't just sprinkle some blueberries on top and hope for the best. You have to rebuild your diet from the ground up. And when you do that and you understand exactly how to do that, and I spell out in the book the different ways you can do this, and there are different options in the book, not just ketogenic diets, but other options. When you build your diet in a way that respects brain biology, you can see tremendous, really dramatic improvements in your mental health, sometimes within a matter of days and usually within a matter of weeks. And we're talking even people who have very serious, long-standing mental health conditions, even people who've been hospitalized multiple times, people who have tried dozens of medications. It almost doesn't matter what the diagnosis is, how long you have had the diagnosis or what you've already tried. If you haven't tried feeding your brain properly, you don't know yet what's possible for you.
I love that. I love that. Can you say it one more time?
Absolutely. If you haven't tried feeding your brain properly, you don't know yet what's possible for you.
I love that. So here's a fun little kind of final question for you then. What do you like to eat?
What I like to eat or what I do eat? I've let go of many delicious things that were not working for me, that were working against me. And that is part of what it takes. We are often told it's about adding things to your diet, but it really, there's a lot more power in subtraction if you know which foods are working against you. And I like to say the first, do no harm, right? So take the things out that are hurting you. And so there are some things I love to eat that I don't eat anymore, but I do really enjoy the way I eat now. And it's a big lifestyle change, but I've been eating this way for so long now. It is second nature to me, and other ways of eating seem strange. So I have a lot of food sensitivity. So keep this in mind, that the way that I eat isn't necessarily the way that I think everybody needs to eat. And I walk people through that in the book, like how to figure out what you can do for yourself based on your goals and your metabolic health and your dietary preferences and your food sensitivities. But what I do, since you asked, is most of my diet is meat, seafood, and poultry. There are a few herbs and a few plant foods that I do include in my diet sometimes. It's not a lot. And so I call my diet carnivorous. This is not really a carnivore diet, although I have done that in the past and may return to it again. But right now it's mostly animal foods, but no dairy or eggs. I don't tolerate those. So it's mostly meat, seafood, and poultry, a few plant foods that are kinder, gentler plant foods that I do well with. And it's a low carbohydrate, it's a ketogenic diet. And I measure my ketones every day, and I essentially don't eat sugar or flour or any grains or anything like that.
And I think to your point, it's something that an individual has to figure out for themselves based on their own limitations, whether those are food sensitivities, sometimes related to access, sometimes related to allergies, sometimes related to certain value systems, so many different components that factor into our diet. And figuring out those pieces in order to get to a place where you are reducing the inflammation and the oxidative stress and the insulin resistance.
Yes. And I'm glad you mentioned that, because you know what I like to say, I'm nutritionally pro-choice, right? So I want people to be able to, I'll help anybody, and the book is written this way too, regardless of your dietary preferences or your sensitivities or your cultural or religious identity around food and the many factors, as you just mentioned. There are lots of ways to improve the brain healthiness of your diet. And it doesn't necessarily mean you have to include animal foods if that's a line that you don't feel comfortable crossing. I give lots of information about how you can modify your diet to work better for your brain, regardless of your dietary preferences. And it was really important to me that I not write a book only about ketogenic diets for mental health. Because I know lots of people out there, a ketogenic diet's going to be a non-starter. But there are so many people who don't need to advance to a ketogenic diet. All they need to do is eat a whole foods diet and understand which whole foods are the ones to focus on. And then they need to adjust the carbohydrate intake in their diet to their personal metabolism. And that may or may not mean a low carbohydrate diet. If you're reasonably metabolically healthy, you get enough exercise and you haven't had too much damage already, you might be able to enjoy all kinds of fruits and vegetables, starchy and sweet whole foods. And so it is intentionally flexible and customizable so that you can find what works best for you.
I love that. And so Change Your Diet, Change Your Mind is on the bookshelves now. Where can folks purchase a copy?
Wherever you like to. I really like Bookshop because bookshop.org because they also support local bookstores, local booksellers, but anywhere that you like to buy books. And there's a whole list of booksellers on my website, and you can choose the one that you prefer to use. So the website is called diagnosisdiet.com. And if you go to the book page there, there are lots of different options in terms of where you'd like to purchase it, or if you just want to learn more about it, or if you just want to ask your local library to stock a copy, if you prefer not to buy it. I'm all for libraries as well.
Wonderful. Well, we'll definitely be sure to link to your website in the show notes. Thank you so much for joining me on this episode of the podcast. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you very much, Dr. Liz, for having me. I hope everybody has a wonderful day.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining me for this week's episode. As you know, my goal is to share with you the most helpful information that moves you towards emotional well-being. If you have suggestions or questions, I'd love to hear those. And I also always appreciate a rating that will help others find this valuable content. I'm looking forward to connecting with you again next week. Please note that while I am a clinical doctor, this podcast is not a substitute for, nor should be taken as medical advice. No specific health advice is being given on this podcast, and no physician-client relationship is created by you listening to this podcast. All information provided on this podcast is for informational purposes only.